You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
And you're tuned in to Morning Edition on KASU Jonesboro. Good morning. It's 8:19. I'm Mark Smith. Joining me by phone this morning is Congressman Rick Crawford, who represents Arkansas's 1st Congressional District in the U.S. House. Good morning, Congressman.
Hey, Mark.
Good to have you with us. Wanted to ask you about this story we just heard on NPR about the budget situation. Why is it that you've had a budget passed, but you can't get it into a conference committee?
Well, I think that's something that leadership is wrestling with. I think the budgets are so far apart in terms of the numbers that they're requesting that they might feel that it may be a little bit unrealistic to think they can conference the two and reconcile the two. But I would think we could go to conference and do what we can to come up with a blueprint, but. You know, again, my issue has been not the budget, but the fact that you can't enforce a budget. It's a statutory measure that really doesn't have any enforcement mechanism. Unless and until we get permanent spending controls, we're wasting our time anyway because we can't hold Congress's feet to the fire with respect to the spending blueprint that they have set forth, whether it's the Senate version or the House version or a conferenced version that's reconciled between the two. It doesn't really matter if we don't have permanent spending controls in place. And, you know, that's why I've been so adamant about, you know, let's do that. Let's get a permanent spending control amendment in place, because I think the American people recognize that we do need to control spending, but it needs to be done in a fundamental reform manner so that future Congresses don't misbehave. I mean, we can talk about our budget all day long, but we don't know what it's going to look like next Congress, regardless of the fact that, you know, for example, the Ryan budget says we're going to balance in 10 years. Well, there's no way to enforce that. And that sounds good. It's awesome to think that we could actually balance our budget in 10 years and then start to pay down debt in a significant way. But if we don't have the permanent spending controls that enforce that budget resolution, which is exactly what it is a non-binding resolution, then we're spinning our wheels anyway. So I really think that we ought to focus more on the fundamental reforms and implementing permanent spending controls than talking about whether or not we can reconcile a budget.
Well, it seems this year that each year brings at least one major weather disaster somewhere, and of course we've had ours this year with the situation in Moore, Oklahoma, the tornado there. We're all hoping that that is the worst, if not the only one this year. Of course, major cleanup needed there, and we're all reminded that this could happen to any of us. This could happen here, as it has in the past here in Jonesboro. Is there any problem with getting disaster assistance where it's needed right now?
Well, what you have, and we saw this with Sandy, is that, you know, obviously there's a move to offset spending, and in this budget environment it's very difficult to pass a supplemental and try to create funding where funding doesn't exist or where resources are limited. So there's going to be a strong push for offsets, and I think that there certainly needs to be a responsible approach to how we appropriate supplemental disaster funds, because we know they're going to happen. And you know, you look at a place like Oklahoma or Arkansas, for example. I was reading this morning that Arkansas is the top 10 states. I think maybe number 10 in the nation with respect to disasters. Mm-hmm. Since 1954, we've had 53 federal disaster declarations in Arkansas that required federal disaster aid. And we've got it all here. You know, we've got flooding at any given time. We've got ice storms. We've got tornadoes. And, you know, Moore, Oklahoma is just an example of something similar. Oklahoma was probably number two or three on the list. And it's not a question of if, it's when and how bad. And so we need to be prepared for that. So maybe we need to look at, maybe creating some sort of a disaster trust fund that could be utilized to get aid quickly where it needs to go without having to fight about the offsets, because we know that we're going to have to provide some federal assistance to these folks. And I think that wherever you live, it would probably be appropriate and responsible to deliver some form of federal aid. It's just how we do it that really, I think, gets creates the controversy.
Yeah, ultimately, you've got to take care of the people first, and worry about where the funds come from later.
I think that's probably the realistic approach. Is that while people are suffering and have, you know, had tremendous loss of life and property and really lost everything in many cases. Probably not as strong an argument to talk about offsets, although, as I said, I think it, you know, I'm not trying to be cavalier with our money. We do need to make sure that if we can find offsets to cover that we do everything we can to do it. But that doesn't need to be the guiding principle about how we deliver federal aid.
Now, over in the Senate, they've also been working on a bipartisan immigration reform bill. What do you think of this effort and its chances?
Well, you know, it continues to be a source of controversy in the Senate. I know that it passed out of committee. It'll come to the floor. There were a lot of amendments, so it's several hundred pages long. What I hope is that we can come up with some sort of a bipartisan approach that does not include amnesty in any form. I think that's counterproductive, and ultimately that would probably torpedo any effort to implement meaningful immigration reform. So we have to be careful about that, and at the same time, we also have to be careful that there is a strong border security provision included. And so it kind of remains to be seen what they're going to deliver. I know that there's a task force at work on the House side, and the House has really kind of chosen to let the Senate take the lead on this particular effort. And so we're just kind of in a holding pattern, waiting to see what they turn out. While this is going on, we've got people sort of behind the scenes actively engaged in trying to implement or deliver some sort of a package that they can reconcile with the Senate version.
Sounds like you got a duck in the background there.
Yeah, that's my texting. Sorry about that.
It's all right. It's just kind of funny. I know a new farm bill is long overdue, of course. What's the latest on this effort?
Well, we passed what I thought was a stellar bipartisan bill out of committee. It's been a week before last, I believe, and really, I think hit the sweet spot with respect to the cuts and the reforms that are necessary to advance a farm bill. I know farmers, and certainly in our district and across the country, are anxious to see a farm bill this year, and we really have everything put together so we could, if for all practical purposes, deliver a farm bill before the current law or the current extension passes on September 30th, and that would be very welcome because, you know, sometimes we get delays with passing a farm bill so that you go into a planting season without knowing what the policy is, and that's unfortunate, and it creates some confusion, and we want to avoid that, and we've got the opportunity to do it. I honestly think we can reconcile our version with the Senate version fairly quickly. There seems to be probably one big sticking point, and that's nutrition. Ours calls for about $20.5 billion in cuts over 10 years. The Senate is not quite that big a number. I think theirs was at $4 billion. So at any rate, I'm sure what we'll see there is a significant reform in nutrition spending, and most of this is achieved through administrative costs and things like categorical eligibility, the LIHEAP program, which is, you know, kind of colloquially referred to as the heat and eat program. Basically what that means is in some parts of the country, if you receive a LIHEAP check in any amount, then you're automatically eligible for food stamps. And really that's unfair. And what we've done is not say we're going to remove that provision, but increase the provision so that the requirement would be $20 check, not just a $1 check, because what we saw in some states is that some states were issuing LIHEAP checks specifically so that they could qualify individuals for SNAP benefits, and that's not a good administration or a responsible approach to administering scarce funds. We need to make sure that we're getting nutrition where it needs to go to the folks who really need it and not folks that are just trying to take advantage of the system. And the one thing I would like to point out, I think I've told you this before, this has virtually no effect at all on the state of Arkansas, and that's because the state of Arkansas has done a very good job administering food stamp and nutrition programs with these federal dollars. So, you know, credit where credit's due, Arkansas has done it right. Therefore, they will be not affected by these cuts in nutrition. So what these are really targeting is those areas where we see a high degree of abuse in programs that are designed to help people and not designed to give people something that they really don't qualify for.
Is there a way to spread or encourage, you know, other states to do what Arkansas has done?
Well, I hope so. In fact, you know, we were having some hearings last year and the year before on that very subject. How do we take, you know, some of these good models, like, for example, Arkansas, and get other states to follow suit? And that's something that we'll continue to deal with on an ongoing basis, but certainly would like to see other states do a better job and be better stewards of, you know, of those taxpayer dollars.
Now, we see the contention in the farm bill seems to be mostly on programs, like you said, like nutrition, things that aren't directly necessarily farm-related. Is there a way to separate these issues out rather than have this huge bill cover everything, or would that just make things more complicated?
Well, I think that it sounds like, well, you know, that's what we need to do is we need to have a food bill and we have a farm bill, but the truth is we'd never pass either one of them. Mm. You've got folks on either side of the aisle, and either and this is not necessarily even a political issue as much as it is a geographic issue.
Regional, yeah.
And so you've got people that are predisposed to vote against a farm bill, and then you have people who are predisposed to vote against nutrition programs. And if you tried to decouple the two, it would be unlikely that you would ever get either of those passed. And so you package those up thinking that, well, what we'll have is, you know, some of these folks that are very pro-nutrition, they'll go ahead and vote to support this, even though they're not necessarily supportive of agriculture, and then vice versa. You know, people from rural districts and so on that might not feel very compelled to support nutrition at the levels that has historically been the case, they might say, well, we need this farm bill, so I'm going to go ahead and vote even though it contains some nutrition. What we've done here is recognizing, first off, that, you know, 75% of the total farm bill, the authorization for the farm bill, is nutrition. About 15% of it is actual production agriculture, mm-hmm. and what the commodity title includes. And so, but the bulk of the cuts have come out of the commodity title. So I would say this, you know, farmers have definitely, you know, carried their weight here and then some. In fact, the Ag Committee is the only authorizing committee that has gone forth and really implemented cuts in a responsible way to hit the number that we needed to hit in this budget environment and done it in a responsible way. So we're kind of leading the way, and the bill passed out of committee on a 35-10 vote. Very, very bipartisan, and definitely earned a spot on the floor. We hope to see it come to the floor this month, actually June. And the majority leader, Eric Cantor, has indicated in writing that he intends to bring the bill to the floor this in June. So, you know, like I said, it's realistic to think that we could get this thing passed and conferenced and signed into law before September 30th, and ultimately that's our goal.
Well, around farming issues, there's a growing protest movement against the company Monsanto for their genetically modified crops and the problems that even Arkansas farmers have had with some of those genetically modified crops popping up in places they're not wanted, and the concern about the power and influence of this company in America's food supply. Are these concerns warranted?
Well, I think what you have to recognize is number one, I mean, the customer is king. And so if we have in the global marketplace, if we have a particular market, for example, the European Union, that says we want non-GMO crops, you're going to see every effort made, particularly by U.S. producers and U.S. interests, to deliver to that market a product that they want. Now, having said that, I think that, you know, the European Union recognizes that you know, when you're there are 300 million people in the United States alone, and it's going to require science and technology to feed the number of people that we have on this planet, and that's going to require you know, some genetically modified organisms, and that is that the real issue, though. I think that what people are protesting about was the fact that they want to see it labeled, and making sure that we're not seeing the co-mingling of GMO and non-GMO products. And that's what we've seen here in our district, where that happened inadvertently, and there was some trace elements found in a shipment in the European Union. This goes back to, I believe it was 2007. And so it was a big controversy, and it really has ginned up a whole lot of enmity on either side of the issue. And what we need to do is recognize, first off, give the consumer what they want, make sure we're implementing every effort and every safeguard to prevent the commingling of GMO and non-GMO products. But also, I think recognizing that there's sound science behind GM crops, and there is a strong need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to feed hungry people across the globe, that with limited resources, it's going to require technology.
Well, just very quickly, less than a minute left, been hearing this morning about President Obama possibly nominating a former Department of Justice official from the Bush administration for FBI Director James Comey. Your thoughts on this nomination?
I don't expect to see any controversy on that. I think probably, there's some appeal, from his administration's perspective, I'm sure, because of his position as an interim Attorney General during John Ashcroft's tenure, and during that period when John Ashcroft was hospitalized, he was an interim and refused to sign a reauthorization on some wiretaps or something. I don't have all the details on it, but I think that sort of appeals to the administration and to Obama supporters. So there is some appeal there. On the other side, the fact that he has been conservative, he's part of a Republican administration, probably plays well to, independence, middle of the road, right, folks that are committed to strong law enforcement.
Well, we didn't get to all the topics we wanted to get to today, but we're out of time. I appreciate your time today, sir.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Representative Rick Crawford joining us from his office here in Jonesboro. You're listening to Morning Edition on KASU.